No sleepovers, no playdates, no TV, no computer games, no grades less than an A. In fact, you must come first for every subject except gym and drama, and you must play the piano or the violin. This is a list of things Amy Chua demanded from her two daughters. Amy Chua is a tiger mother. Tiger parenting has come under intense scrutiny in the West, often being called barbaric and cruel. Today, we're going to explore why tiger parenting is a thing and how this parenting style is actually carried out, as tiger parenting is often associated with Chinese parenting due to similarities in their core values. We'll be examining both types side by side. Now let's dive into the minds of tiger parents. What drives a mother to create a list like this? And is this considered good parenting, especially in countries like China, where this style is often associated with? Finally, I also want to know, how do the kids feel about this? Grab a drink and get comfy, because we are going to go deep into the world of Chinese and tiger parenting. Tiger parenting and Chinese parenting are not the same thing, but they share many similarities. For example, both tiger parents and Chinese parents will often demand perfection when it comes to academics, and they'll also push their kids hard. So straight away, I have two questions. Why is getting good grades such a big deal? And why is it necessary to push your kids so hard? To answer that first question on why there's a fixation on good grades, we need to bring in some Chinese philosophy, more specifically, Confucianism. Confucianism emphasizes that parents have a great responsibility in shaping their children to be virtuous. If you took a more laid-back and hands-off approach, you aren't doing your job right. As a parent, you're meant to take every opportunity to educate and instill the correct values in them. This opportunity education, as termed by Flory Ng, is probably why every time I show my parents a meme or a joke, instead of laughing, they begin to turn it into a one-hour lecture, and I start regretting my life decisions. Many of the actions Chinese parents take are based off fulfilling their duty, which is to foster virtue in their kids. And you know what fosters virtue? Education. In fact, that was the whole point of studying in Confucius' eyes. Studying was all about the process, the constant grind in improving oneself both in knowledge and in character. Education in China is therefore a moral pursuit. At the same time, studying had very tangible effects. Doing well in an exam could change your life. The imperial examination back in 680 China was a way for peasants to attain prestigious government positions, a big jump in status, living standards, and future life trajectory. The imperial exam was a mechanism for significant social mobility, and it lives on today in modern China through the infamous Gaokao, China's hugely stressful university admission exam. This is why Chinese parents see more than just marks on a test when they're handed an exam score. They see the result of a moral endeavor. They see social recognition, and they see a future with greater opportunities for upwards mobility. And all this leads to Chinese parents having very high expectations when it comes to grades, because nothing else holds the same weight or promise in Chinese culture as your marks. As a result, Chinese parents adopt some pretty distinct parenting strategies to encourage kids to study. After all, no child is born wanting to flip open their math textbook, keen to begin grinding endless questions. So how would one enforce this? This is where we introduce the first characteristic of the Chinese parenting style, which also applies to tiger parenting, and that is high levels of control. Pomerantz and colleagues in their study on parental involvement defines control as parenting characterized by pressure, intrusiveness, and dominance. And Chinese parents have been shown to be more controlling in multiple papers, like how mainland Chinese parents make more decisions for their children on who their friends should be and what they should wear. Outside of China, young immigrant respondents from the US also indicated their parents were more psychologically controlling than European American parents. Although Chinese parents may score highly on measures of control, calling them controlling often imbues a Western perspective on this practice, which is not the best because we overlook some crucial cultural motives that drive such controlling behaviors. First, high levels of control are often associated with cultural hierarchy models. In Chinese culture, relationships are structured hierarchically. Your parents are more senior than you, and as a subordinate, you obey and respect them. Confucius, other than emphasizing hierarchies within the family, also said that parents being an authority figure had a duty to train and govern their child. This is really important because this expectation emphasizes two cultural concepts known as jiaoxun and guan, and they are core to understanding why Chinese parenting, and to a degree, tiger parenting, might be seen as controlling and overbearing in the West, but is completely acceptable in China. So what is the idea of training and governing about? Training sounds rather militaristic in English, like I'm about to tell you to drop and give me 50 push-ups, but it's not like that at all in Chinese. When you train your child, it's really just about teaching them how they should behave in a socially acceptable way. This is very important because in Chinese culture, how well-behaved or poorly behaved your child is reflects directly on one's parenting skills. For example, if I was in Woolies or Walmart for the Americans, and my friends and I saw a kid fall to his knees in an aisle screaming and crying, shortly followed by their parent looking absolutely mortified, we would probably feel bad for the parent because we can leave the aisle, but that parent has to take the banshee home. Now, if I was with my family, I guarantee my mom and grandparents would not feel bad for this parent. Instead, they will probably condemn the parent as not having trained the kid properly because of the kid's appalling behavior. The parent in Chinese culture is held responsible for how the child behaves. If a child is well-mannered, polite, and respectful, then the parent gets all the credit, and the opposite holds true too. But training isn't just about making sure your child is polite. Another crucial measure of a well-trained child is how well they do in school. We already talked about how important academic success is, so hopefully this does not come as a surprise. A child that excels at school exemplifies the cultural ideal, and this is the biggest flex for a Chinese parent. Right, so that's the core parts of training or 教训. Before we take a look at some pretty eye-opening examples of it being put into practice, let me also walk you through the idea of 管, to govern, which goes hand in hand with training. Governing a child has a positive connotation behind it, and 管 at times can also be translated as to care for or to love, though I doubt any kid hearing their parents say, get off the computer and start doing homework, will see that as love in the moment. Training and governing both reflect high levels of parental involvement, but training emphasizes a more educational aspect, whereas governing encompasses a broader oversight. Now, let's put this theory into practice so you can see how these values manifest in Chinese parenting. Think of training and governing a child like nurturing a new seedling and making sure it grows well. Except in your mind, there's only one right way for the plant to grow, and there's a lot for you to do. The first step is to make sure it's in a good environment. You gotta make sure the plant has enough sunlight, it's got enough room, and there aren't pests around. When it comes to Chinese parents creating a good environment for their child, it's really the same. To ensure an optimal study environment for their kids, Chinese parents will often shuffle around their own schedules and even reorganize the house so the child has a quiet place to focus, free of distractions. This means parents might watch the TV with low volume or move loud activities to other parts of the house. A child will often have their own study room, and if there isn't enough space in the house to create a good study environment, Chinese parents might build a whole new room by themselves so you have no excuse now but to study. And by Chinese parents, I really mean my dad, who literally built my study from scratch. I didn't even know he had that in him. It's like the story of a mom getting superhero powers when her kids are trapped under a car, but Chinese parents get hit with superhero powers when their kids' grades are threatened to fall from a 98 to a 95. A kid is also not going to be able to grow well physically or mentally if they're lacking in nutrients. Chinese parents will often cook delicious food the child likes as a reward for their hard work studying. You'll also commonly find Chinese parents preparing highly nutritious foods during exam periods as an extra brain boost. Chinese children are also often exempt from household chores like washing dishes, cleaning bathrooms, or vacuuming floors because Chinese parents recognize their time is valuable and is better used on things like studying. In case you haven't noticed, the sun isn't the center of the universe. The Chinese kid studying at home is, and everything is done with them in mind. Continuing on with our plant analogy, just like how you have to prune a plant sometimes and cut off side shoots to redirect nutrients to the main branches, Chinese parents often find it justified to ban certain activities like gaming or watching TV so they can redirect the kids' most valuable resource, time, to studying. Often this comes in the form of a strict routine that Chinese parents set, like come home from school, practice your instrument for an hour, and then do homework for 2 hours, and then maybe after dinner you can get 10 minutes of TV, and then you're back to studying. Such parental control can also extend to a child's social life. Chinese parents can and will grab their shears to cut off your friends for you if they're not thought to be a good influence. In a 2003 paper written by Qi and Rao on Chinese parenting beliefs in rural China, many parents talked about how they didn't want their children to hang out with other unruly children in the village. They believed that these more problematic children could affect their own kids and, in particular, their studies. This level of parental control is socially accepted, and such behavior is actually reflected in a famous Chinese proverb that may have influenced Chinese people's beliefs. The proverb is Meng Mu San Qian, or Mencius's mother moves three times. Mencius was a young Chinese kid back in ancient China, and the story goes that he and his mom at first lived near a graveyard. Mencius's mom catches him making a game out of burying dead people, and she immediately realized he was copying what the adults were doing, except Mencius was too young to understand feelings of grief or loss associated with burials. She didn't like how Mencius was getting easily influenced, and believed that Mencius having fun from imitating a burial procedure might lead to him losing compassion and empathy later when he grew up, so she packed their bags and whisked him away. Next, they stayed near a marketplace. Here, Mencius began imitating merchants and the way they sold things. This doesn't sound like an issue until you realize that merchants were at the bottom of the social hierarchy under Confucius' thought because of how they prioritized profit and didn't contribute to societal welfare. Naturally, Mencius's mother did not want her son to model himself after merchants, so once again, she whisked him away. Finally, they settled near a school. In this environment, Mencius began to imitate scholars and their behavior, and this was finally Mencius' mom approved, as it was ideal for his education. Mencius, by the way, is not just a random person from ancient China. He is actually one of the most notable philosophers in Chinese history, second only to Confucius himself. So one has to ask, without Mencius' mother moving him 3 times before they reached the school, would Mencius have become the same renowned thinker if he stayed at the graveyard or near the merchants? This is the question that lives rent-free in the minds of Chinese parents. It's why they'll feel like they need to intervene when it comes to friends or the way their child spends time. In Chinese culture, the tale of Mencius' mother is not one about control. It's about parental dedication and sacrifice, of prioritizing your child's future and development over doing what's easy for you. Speaking of easy, when I was referencing the story of Mencius' mother moving, I used a Chinese source and I had to blur out all the subtitles because they got in the way. But imagine watching a video like this and instead of finding foreign subtitles distracting, actually being able to read it. Like, look at this video. I can see dual language subtitles, click on the subtitles, and the video actually pauses and allows me to check the definition of the words. How do I do this? I used a Chrome extension called Migaku. If you're an anime or K-drama or C-drama fan, I'm gonna make a guess that you like the culture too, and you've had thoughts of learning the language. Well, this is your sign to do it, and it's never been easier. The Migaku web extension keeps track of all the words you know, and oh my gosh, with the extension, the whole world is your oyster. Like, you can make flashcards of the actual video. I don't want to see boring Enki decks ever again, because with Migaku, if I don't know this particular word, I can click on it and it will generate a flashcard with the word's definition and a sample sentence using the exact dialogue from the video. It'll also contain a cool image screenshot from the video for all of us visual learners out there, and an AI-powered explanation of the word to put it in further context. Once this flashcard is created, it can then be studied within Migaku's spaced repetition flashcard system called Migaku Memory. You can even watch YouTube through the Migaku app and create flashcards while being on your phone, which is super handy. You guys thought the green owl was menacing? What should I become if I hear anyone complain learning a language is too hard again after I've just shown you Migaku exists? So download Migaku today. It starts from just $9 a month, or if you're like me and you want to be one and done, I got you. You can get 50% off their lifetime access with my link. And this works for all languages. Thank you, Migaku, for sponsoring this video. And now back to my plant analogies, because yeah, I warned you, I came up with way too many of them. And now the last plant analogy, I swear. If you want your plant to grow vertically, often you'd get a support in place so they grow nice and tall, leaning on that support. Chinese parents are the support that backs such ambitious and intense study routines their child has to carry out. Parents will often spend an exhaustive amount of time staying by their kids' side, acting as moral support, and to also answer any questions on homework kids might have to the best of their ability. Because succeeding in academics is so important, Chinese parents are not going to leave things up to chance and just pray they have a kid who's naturally smart and can pick up concepts like that. Regardless of talent, it's hard work that matters most in Chinese culture, and parents are there to enforce that. Traditional Chinese culture did not explicitly outline that parents had to help their children with schoolwork because back then only few people were literate, but as education became more widespread, more parents were able to directly assist with tutoring their kids at home. That being said, as children progress through the curriculum and as their schoolwork gets harder, many parents find themselves unable to keep up with the content and help their kids in that way. So they begin to shift from providing direct assistance to more indirect methods, many of which we've covered through my excessive plant analogies. Now, at this point, All of these parenting strategies we've covered share one thing in common, and that is it's all very one-sided. The parents are the ones dictating routines on how long to study and when to do things. The child doesn't get a seat at the proverbial decision-making table, which brings me to a parenting strategy that's quite different from what we've seen so far. It's called 讲道理, which means to reason. And unlike making your child study for 5 hours straight or choosing who they hang out with, this is a strategy that influences change from the inside out, rather than the outside in. When Chinese parents employ reasoning, it is an open and honest two-way conversation. Chinese parents aim to explain to their child why it's important to work hard. They might even mention how good grades would lead to a better life for both the child and the family, essentially reinforcing ties of academic achievement to moral obligations and filial piety. During these kinds of sit-down sessions, parents often conduct the conversation with a positive tone, expressing their belief and confidence that their daughter or son can excel. At the same time, parents also often communicate the importance of effort over ability. Maybe the child isn't achieving the best marks at the moment, but the parent is saying that they believe the child has it in them to do better if they just put in more work. And the plant won't be reaching for the sky alone. The support is always there, right beside them. In a 2013 paper written by Kim and Fong on Chinese parenting techniques, reasoning was a strategy that was looked back upon very fondly by Chinese adults when they thought about the ways their parents got involved. Chen Zuo remarks that his mother talking reason to him helped him understand why, and that he would study harder as a result because if you study harder, your parents would be happier. Reasoning leverages core Chinese cultural concepts to motivate children to study harder, and parents in turn are motivated to behave and adopt such parenting practices because of Confucian ideologies like training and governing, and because of China's societal structure. Yet, as Charles says in her hugely influential 1994 paper, neither of these cultural concepts were previously identified in Western literature when assessing parenting styles. This is really important because from a Western perspective, the Chinese parenting style is often viewed as authoritarian, lending from Bormann's 1971 paper conceptualizing the term. Authoritarian parenting is described as an absolute parenting style with no explanations, listening, or emotional support. But as you can see, though typical Chinese parenting has a high level of control, Chinese parents do offer emotional support. Chow argues against defining Chinese parenting as authoritarian because the Chinese parent's intention is not to dominate the child, but to uphold societal norms both in raising a proper child and being proper parents themselves. Hopefully, all of this cultural context has allowed you to better understand what goes on inside the mind of a typical Chinese parent and why Chinese parenting is the way it has become. Now we're set up to examine tiger parenting, which has many overlaps with the Chinese parenting style, but you'll soon see for yourself that it's not the same. Let's talk about the most infamous tiger mother in the West, Amy Chua, and her wildly controversial, entertaining, and slightly terrifying 2011 memoir titled Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. If you've never heard about this book before, you will see everything we just discussed intensified a hundredfold, and I hope you're ready. Here's how we're going to do this. We're going to talk through Chua's parenting tactics, and then we're going to bring it back to what the majority of Chinese parents do, because I would hate for you to think what we're about to witness is how every Chinese parent acts. Chua starts her memoir with a list of things her two daughters, Sophia and Louisa, or Lulu for short, were never allowed to do, which we saw at the beginning of this video. Chua quotes two papers, one of which is Charles that we actually referenced earlier. Chua says, in one study of 50 Western American mothers and 48 Chinese immigrant mothers, almost 70% of the Western mothers said either that stressing academic success is not good for children, or that parents need to foster the idea that learning is fun. By contrast, roughly 0% of Chinese mothers felt the same way. Instead, the vast majority of Chinese mothers said that they believe the child can be the best student, that academic achievement reflects successful parenting, and that if children did not excel at school, then there was a problem, and parents were not doing their job. Without any context, Chinese parents sound pretty ruthless here, as if they don't care about their children at all and they only want to see high scores. But this paragraph reflects exactly the undeniable influence of Confucian thought, of how he shaped a whole society to value academic excellence, and how his ideas of what a parent's duty was became the blueprint for how Chinese parents would train and govern their children for millennia to come. That being said though, America is obviously very different to China. It has a totally different set of values, history, and culture. So how is Chua going to implement Chinese parenting methods in such a different environment? And is it going to be as effective? Well, one of the earliest anecdotes Chua shares is the story of how she introduced her daughters to their instruments. Lulu, Chua's younger daughter, is 3 years old and is about to touch the piano for the first time. Chua shows her how to press down on a key, and then it's Lulu's turn to do the same. However, instead of copying what Chua does, Lulu screams and bashes all the keys, and Chua can't get her to calm down or cooperate. After 15 minutes of this, Chua has had enough, and she drags Lulu to the back door and flings it open. It's the middle of winter, so they immediately get blasted with frigid cold air, and Chua says, "You can't stay in the house if you don't listen to mommy. Now, are you ready to be a good girl, or do you want to go outside?" Chua explains that she was determined to raise an obedient child, and Lulu was about to learn how to obey. However, to her surprise, Lulu steps outside in an act of defiance. In the end, Chua realizes her daughter would sooner freeze to death than be a good girl and obey, so she does cave. She quickly begs for her daughter to come back and plops her into a warm bath to get her temperature up again. Chua wasn't able to quite instill obedience into Lulu as she had hoped, but this doesn't stop her from trying. Chua links this determination to foster obedience in her children with Chinese values, stating that in Chinese culture, obedience is considered among the highest of virtues. And she is right in that obedience and respect for senior authority figures is a core part of Chinese culture. But most Chinese parents, as observed in and colleagues' 2017 study, are generally less critical of younger children and their performance than compared to when they grow up. This is largely because A, young children are not assumed to be at an age of understanding yet, and B, because there's just more at stake when kids grow up to be adolescents. But we don't see Chua extending her 3-year-old daughter nearly the same grace. My point here is, and we'll see this time and time again, whilst Chua's rationale does stem from Chinese beliefs, the lengths she goes to is really not representative of your average Chinese parent. Chua also holds very high expectations for her daughters and their pursuits in music. Here are some comments she's made to her daughters as she supervises their playing. "Oh my god, you're just getting worse and worse. If the next time's not perfect, I'm gonna take all your stuffed animals and burn them." She's also on other occasions told one of her daughters to stop being lazy, cowardly, self-indulgent, and pathetic. Chua also constantly uses threats like cancelling Lulu's bar mitzvah if she doesn't play the violin then, or saying things like, "You'll get no lunch, no dinner, no Christmas or Hanukkah, and no birthday presents for the next 2, 3, even 4 years if you don't nail this piano piece." Yeah, and she was committed to carrying out those threats. Chua states the Chinese can get away with saying and doing things like this because of 3 reasons. 1. Western parents care a lot about their kids' self-esteem. In Chua's words, she says, "First, I've noticed that Western parents are extremely anxious about their children's self-esteem. They worry about how their children will feel if they fail at something, and they constantly try to reassure their children about how good they are, notwithstanding a mediocre performance in a test or at a recital." In other words, Western parents are concerned about their children's psyches. Chinese parents aren't. They assume strength, not fragility, and as a result, they behave very differently. I feel like I need to start calling in some removalists because there is so much to unpack here. With her first point, she does raise an interesting cultural difference between the West and China, with what parents perceive their biggest role is. According to Ng's 2007 paper, East Asian parents place an emphasis on self-improvement, whereas North American parents emphasize self-enhancement. What this means is, North American moms are more likely to point out the positives in their child as they believe fostering self-esteem is a core child-rearing goal and is key to their child's future success and well-being. In contrast, East Asian moms are more likely to see self-esteem as unimportant and even undesirable, as high self-esteem might interfere a child from being receptive to feedback. Instead of focusing on self-esteem, East Asian moms believe their role is to help their child better their performance. Or you could say that East Asian moms make it a personal mission to humble you as soon as you get a shred of self-confidence, whereas North American moms are really out here saying, "No, any girl would be lucky to date you, even if you've been chronically single for 25 years. I'm sorry, no one is safe. East Asian parents will also consciously choose to highlight failure because it's through failure that one learns and improves, whereas North American parents will highlight success because that is what builds a child's self-esteem. So, Chua's observation is actually backed by academic studies, but framing this difference as a matter of strength and fragility does neither culture justice. Next, Chua says the second reason why Chinese parents can get away with saying and doing certain things is because Chinese parents believe their kids owe them everything. And she chalks this belief up to Confucius thinking and the fact that Chinese parents usually sacrifice a lot for their children. This way of thinking is very common and it largely stems from the notion of filial piety, or xiao in Confucius' thought. It's the idea that children are indebted to their parents for giving them life, and they're obligated in return to respect, care for, and obey their parents. What's interesting here is Chua's immediate comparison of this way of thinking to how her husband thinks. Her husband, Jed Rubenfeld, is of Jewish background, and he very much has the opposite view. Rubenfeld says, "Children don't choose their parents. They don't even choose to be born. It's parents who force life on their kids, so it's the parents' responsibility to provide for them. Kids don't owe their parents anything. Their duty will be to their own kids." And Chua sardonically comments, "That sounds like a terrible deal for the Western parent." This difference in thinking gives us more insight into why Chinese parents perhaps feel more justified in exerting higher levels of control and commanding obedience compared to Western parents, who generally offer more freedom and encourage the questioning of authority. It's just two completely different cultural beliefs that shape what actions and behaviors are accepted. Chua's final observation of why Chinese parents seem to get away with things more is that Chinese parents believe they know what's best for their children and therefore override all of their children's own desires and preferences. She then again draws a comparison between how her parents treated her and how her husband's parents treated him. Jed's parents gave him a choice about whether he wanted to take violin lessons, which he declined and now regrets, and thought of him as a human being with views. My parents didn't give me any choices and never asked for my opinion on anything. I mean, it's honestly quite sad seeing that last sentence. When you read this book, you kind of think to yourself, wow, how can she be so tough on her kids? And then every time Chua mentions her parents, all the dots connect. Chua mentions how Chinese parents often override their child's preference, and I'm sure you could see elements of this in the first part of the video. This sentiment is often justified on the basis of filial piety and reinforced by the existence of strong hierarchies in Chinese culture, which emphasize that obedience to authority. Chinese culture, being collectivist as well, also means the interest of the group, in this case the family, will take precedence over wishes of the individual, or the child. All of this explains such behavior, but still, Chua's parents completely disregarding her feelings, thoughts, and opinions on everything is a rather extreme manifestation of such values. It's also hard to miss her not-so-subtle snark at how her husband's parents granted him with too much autonomy as a child, leading Rubenfeld to regret his choice of quitting the violin. Honestly, I think this just illustrates how hard parenting is. Good parents, irrespective of culture, should have their child's best interests at heart, and they'll act accordingly. But there's always going to be regrets or times where they feel like they should have pushed harder or been more lax. And this is not unique to any particular parenting style or culture. Chua elaborates, many Chinese secretly believe that they care more about their children and are willing to sacrifice much more for them than Westerners, who seem perfectly content to let their children turn out badly. I think it's a misunderstanding on both sides. All decent parents want to do what's best for their children. The Chinese just have a totally different idea of how to do that. And I think this might be Chua's most sane take on parenting in this entire book. Everyone's experience with their parents is unique, and that shapes how they might parent their own child if that's something they want. How can we make these comparisons and objectively assess what's better or worse when everyone turns out differently and experiences parenting in their own way? As a personal example, I have an older brother and we were raised very differently. He got the full Western style parenting method. My parents were super chill with him and there was no pressure on him to do anything he didn't want to. Then when I was born, my grandparents had their own plan and I was raised under a more traditional Chinese style. My grandparents drilled me for maths and they would stay by my side supervising me as I did my homework. I vividly remember coming back to school with my brother and he would turn on the TV first thing and begin watching his TV shows whilst I went to the room next door, put my bag down and started practicing the piano. After which I would begin drilling math problems from Chinese textbooks that were 2-3 years ahead. Anyways, now that we're older, we live pretty different lives, and here's the thing. We're both happy with where we are now, which is the most important bit, and interestingly, neither of us would want to trade lives with each other. So there we go. Chua summarizes the differences in the two parenting styles as such. Let me know if you agree with her take. Western parents try to respect their children's individuality, encouraging them to pursue their true passions, supporting their choices, and providing positive reinforcement and a nurturing environment. By contrast, the Chinese believe that the best way to protect their children is by preparing them for the future, letting them see what they're capable of, and arming them with skills, work habits, and inner confidence that no one can ever take away. In this last part of the video, I want to take a look at the children, because all of this is for them, right? So how do they feel about it? The answer might surprise you. There's a famous Chinese proverb that goes, 吃得苦中苦, 方为人上人, and meaning-wise, this translates to be the best, you must suffer the worst. This is a core belief of Chinese parenting. Childhood is not assumed to be fun, because if you have fun now, you will pay for it when you're older. Chinese people are able to confidently make this assumption because ideals of success are so clearly defined in the culture and because everyone will continue conforming to it. Therefore, Chinese kids go through a lot at a young age, but the question remains, was it all worth it? And now that they're all grown and maybe at an age where they might have kids themselves, how would they raise their own children? Respondents in Kim and Fong's study reflected on how their parents raised them, and it was a complex mishmash of emotions. For example, Lee states she felt like she was always under a lot of pressure, and she was especially scared of her father, who was strict and would criticize her if she got too lazy in her studies. Yet, she immediately follows this with, "It was okay, acceptable. I felt that the pressure he gave me was justified and reasonable. It wasn't over the top or anything." Despite having some negative memories, Lee felt like her father's behavior was justified and reasonable. Clearly, it wasn't pleasant back then, but she understands now where her father was coming from, and that understanding is an interpretation of an action imbued with cultural context. Chen Zhuo, another respondent, says this, "At the time, of course, it's very annoying because I would want to play outside instead of study. But now that I am grown up, I say to my parents, if my mother had not been so responsible, I wouldn't have been able to go to college." Another respondent, Jiao Jing, criticized her parents, who were less involved because they were both busy with work. In Jiao Jing's eyes, her parents had not fulfilled their parental roles and expectations. She indicated that when she has her own children, she would definitely get more involved with their education. The respondents all agreed that their parents' involvement was necessary, even if they might not have appreciated it then. And of course, much of this reflection is rooted in China's cutthroat culture and the core values that have been passed down. However, when we take the same parenting style outside of China and essentially remove it from both the culture and society it was shaped by, we find quite a different response. If we take a look at Asian Americans, for example, they grow up in a completely different environment and culture to what their parents know. Them being raised in a more individualistic society like the US may lead to them experiencing a disconnect with the more traditional collectivist values that are deeply rooted in their parents. Chinese parents in China do what they can to give their child the best chance to survive a brutal system based on academics, but there are far more diverse pathways to success in America, so Chinese parents stressing only academic excellence can be seen as unnecessarily restrictive. Warren Ng, a psychiatry professor at Columbia University, elaborates on this difference as he tells NBC News. "Those who were born in the US tend to reflect an acculturation to American society, which more generally has become hesitant about strict parenting. Often, this generation encourages their children to find their own passions rather than assume a more duty-bound lifestyle that previous generations grew up with. These old-school Confucian family dynamics are increasingly being tempered with a sense of autonomy." Lee, a father of a 20-year-old and a 17-year-old, says in the same NBC article that his kids have a strong idea of what they want to do in life, with them both looking to enter the gaming industry, and he says it's not up to him to change that. "They're both sort of arts-related, and God knows if they're going to be able to make money there, but I'd rather they have a direction that they feel agency in than me trying to impose something upon them." Angela Im tells NBC that she tries to encourage her 6-year-old to study rather than demanding it. "I think most of us would agree that these approaches are healthy and supportive. But again, these are actions undertaken in America. We can't expect Chinese parents to do the same in China because they're playing by totally different rules over there. For example, Chinese kids don't have the luxury of simply being encouraged to study. And I think that fact speaks more about the system in China rather than its people." Finally, coming back to Chua, despite how much she put a children and herself through, her two children did turn out to be the undisputed high achievers that she wished for. Sophia is a military lawyer who graduated from Yale Law School, and Lulu is also a lawyer working at the US Court of Appeals after graduating from Harvard. In reflecting on their experiences, Lulu tells the Daily Mail, "There were happy moments and difficult moments, and it was maybe a less carefree childhood than a lot of other people's. I lost that childhood innocence, that sense of joy and wonder, and I definitely felt a lot of stress. I think it's important to be honest about the highs and lows of tiger parenting. No one would believe me if I said everything was perfect all the time and I was constantly happy. I do think the good outweighs the bad, and I'm proud of my parents and myself now, but I definitely think things could have been different." And Sophia says this about her childhood to The Telegraph. "Everyone talks about my mother threatening to throw my toys in the fire, but the funny thing is, that was not a major memory. I remember my childhood as happy. I'm not scared of my mom and never have been. It was my dad who I was much more afraid of disappointing. It was always unequivocally clear in my mind that my parents were on my side no matter what. They did have high expectations of me, but it was because they had the confidence that I could do amazing things." The parenting methods one adopts is often deeply personal and shaped inextricably by social cultural factors. Today, we first looked at Chinese parenting. Chinese parents carry a unique set of cultural expectations which influences the actions they take to ensure their children succeed within the societal context. This set us up to then take on tiger parenting, which shares similarities but often takes these core values to an unhealthy extreme and shouldn't be conflated with Chinese parenting. Finally, we looked at how adults reflected on their childhood, and we could see some pretty interesting differences between how mainland Chinese adults and Asian Americans would raise the next generation. If you want to see the full intensity of tiger parenting, I'd actually really recommend Chua's memoir. Her whole story is crazy and it will leave you with a lot to think about. Lastly, if you wanted to share any of your experiences with your parents growing up, how their parenting style may have impacted you, whether you would do the same or parent differently in the future, I would also be really interested in hearing your story. If you made it this far, you're contractually obligated to subscribe. And if you don't subscribe, I will yeet Snorlax. Thank you for watching all the way until the end, and a big thank you as always to my wonderful patrons for all their support. See you in the next video. Bye!